some people talk against it, but yet those people are the people that already have it made.
Alaska lawmakers grapple with what should stay in the federal stimulus proposal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 3rd of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, turning wood waste into pelletized fuel for the interior.
We end up having between 100 and 150 tons of kiln-dried material every year that has just been thrown away. So we want to take advantage of that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
As the U.S. Senate forges into a large file of amendments to the economic stimulus bill this week, the state legislature opened debate today on resolutions that will give a statewide view of Alaska's issues. About $1 billion is expected to be directed at the state's economy. The director of the state's office in Washington, D.C., John Katz, told the State House Finance Committee today that some of the concerns Governor Palin expressed in a letter to the state's delegation yesterday have already been addressed. He expects a delay in deadlines for Alaska to use the money because of its short construction season. He also says there are only a few social programs that might be expanded, and the only one that might carry over after the stimulus money is gone would be medical assistance. Katz said most members of Congress have decided on the need for some sort of economic stimulus for the nation. The debate is over the details. He calls it a work in progress.
The Democratic leadership has indicated that they will certainly be willing to entertain amendments and make some changes, but they don't want it to be a limitless process. On the Republican side, they say they're not stalling, that these are genuine concerns, and that the amendments through the week will be an effort to create what most members believe of is a satisfactory balance between infrastructure spending, tax reduction, and a social net that would deal with things like unemployment insurance, education, health care, etc.
The House resolution only makes two requests to the congressional delegation. First, that the state get its fair share of the money, and second, that it be directed to all segments of the state's economy. But the legislature is not united on those points. Mike Kelly of Fairbanks voted against the resolution because he doesn't like the entire economic stimulus plan. He says the state will not be able to maintain any increase in spending.
If this program creates anything other than getting some stuff done in the infrastructure arena that has no hangover from the binge, I'm against it. No matter how wonderful it sounds in here as we add everything under the sun into this resolution, this is a mistake.
Woody Salmon of Chalkeetsuk said his district has been in an economic slump since statehood, and people there need the help now more than ever.
Some people talk against it, but yet those people are the people that already have it made. If they live in my district and try to secure employment in the villages, I mean, they'll have a different perspective of how this economic of the state is.
The resolution passed from the committee and will next be heard on the House floor. As the U.S. Senate debates the economic stimulus bill this week, groups from all over the country are clamoring to see their priorities included. Native American and Alaska Native leaders are making sure tribes have a piece of the stimulus pie. At this point, nearly $3 billion of the more than $800 billion package would go to Indian country. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The nearly $3 billion of stimulus money slated to go to tribes is only half of what the National Congress of American Indians originally asked for. Despite that, the stimulus bill is still getting the support of many in Indian country who say the money is needed as soon as possible. The biggest pots of money would go to health services and building projects. The funds would be funneled through agencies like the Indian Health Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and some would also go through states. However, Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka wants to see as much as possible go directly to tribes.
Primarily that it doesn't go through the states, that it goes right to Native federally recognized tribes, and that it goes in through the existing channels of resources. So, for example, if our tribes generally run the program, that the money goes to the tribes. If our regional tribal consortiums generally run the programs, that it goes to them. If our health corporations run the program, it goes to them, as opposed to being pooled up in the state.
Kitka says she hopes the definition of Indian tribes is as inclusive as possible, so it might include Alaska Native corporations. However, many tribal leaders are opposed to the idea of corporations being considered tribes, since the corporations are economic business organizations, not government entities. Julie Kitka would also like to see the Buy Indian Act expanded. It calls for federal agencies to make purchases from Native American organizations and businesses, and Kitka would like to see it used more broadly so that any stimulus projects done in Indian country will be sure to employ Native Americans.
And we would like to see the Buy Indian provisions extended not just to Department of Interior, Indian Health Service, but extended across the agencies. So any stream of money which is primarily intended to benefit Native Americans, have those provisions apply to that. So basically you could get the maximum benefit out of the resources for the intended beneficiaries, which would be Native Americans.
Some of the stimulus money destined for tribes is slated for programs that aren't in Alaska. But Kitka hopes there are still creative ways to make sure Alaska gets some of that pot. For example, money that would go to Bureau of Indian Affairs schools.
We hope that there'll be some provision of that eligible to be used for education in Alaska for Native children up here as well. Just the fact we don't have BIA schools shouldn't preclude us from having access to some of those resources.
And there's a key point to consider as the stimulus package is hashed out this week: what happens after the money is allocated. The struggle isn't over once the stimulus package passes. The next question will be how individual agencies divvy up the funds throughout Indian country. Kitka says she'll be watching closely.
I think that there's a lot of things that still have to be sorted out once the Congress takes action, and there'll be a lot of negotiations going on with the federal agencies, and we're just hopeful that things can get enacted by the Congress and that people can start going to work on this.
Regardless of what exactly the $3 billion goes toward, Kitka says tribes need the help. She says the backlog is overwhelming, especially in housing and health projects.
So, for example, new money coming into Native American housing can get absorbed very quickly. And, you know, whether or not you're talking about weatherization, whether or not you're talking about remodel and upgrading existing housing stock, or whether or not you're talking about, you know, water and sewer connections to housing projects, that if new money is made available, people already have their priorities, they have the systems in place, and they just have been lacking the funds to do it.
Kitka says the stimulus bill is moving so fast, and in an ideal world, there would be more time for hearings and brainstorming sessions, but Kitka says she believes time is of the essence, and Alaska Native tribes can't wait. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Palin administration is asking the legislature to make some changes to the budget that was approved last year. While much of the supplemental budget introduced today will affect tax credits for the state's oil producers, some programs and people will also feel the effects. The bottom line of the new plan cuts $268 million from last year's operating and capital budgets. In sending the new plan to the legislature, Governor Palin wrote that it is based on well more than $1 billion less in revenue than was expected last spring. The governor referred to an amended fiscal projection from the Revenue Department released today. Senate Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman said the cuts were not as significant as the new revenue projections, now expected to be about $2 billion less than anticipated. He says the legislature saved money last year, and it will use some of it to minimize the roller coaster effect on the budget.
The state operating budget should not be an up and down situation depending on what the price of oil is. You know, but that doesn't mean that we can't be frugal. I think that we need to tighten our belts as much as we can to stretch our savings out as long as we can.
One of the bigger concerns with the new budget is some $13 million in unspecified cuts that leave the final decision on spending to the executive branch departments. Hoffman says those unallocated reductions don't show where the real priorities will be focused.
If we don't have them identified, it's hard to agree or disagree with those categories. So I think that the administration needs to look at the budget and be more specific, because that's how the administration sets their priorities. With an unallocated reduction, it does not give us that insight.
The Senate Finance Committee will get its first explanation on the supplemental budget from the administration tomorrow morning. It will get a detailed explanation of the new revenue projections on Thursday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a slow pollock season affects more than fishermen.
Been up here about a month now and probably made about $200. So it's really bad right now.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Alabama sociologist Steve Picou made his reputation studying the social impacts of the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. Then Hurricane Katrina hit in his own backyard. Today, he warned people at the Alaska Forum on the Environment that these events are just a taste of catastrophes to come. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Whether it comes from climate warming, terrorism, or plague, Picou said Alaskans need to learn to be more socially resilient in the face of what he calls catastrophes, like erosion that's forcing the relocation of native coastal villages.
The most pressing problem in relocating communities is the maintenance of culture, social organization, and traditions. And so the fallout will be, once the community is relocated, how do you maintain that beautiful, wonderful culture that was so important in the original community, in the original geographical location?
Picou's data on the 1989 oil spill's impacts on Cordova show that stress in the community was as high in 2006 as it was in 1991, partly because of the 20 years of litigation that followed the spill. Now he's discovering stress lingering from Hurricane Katrina. This time it may be linked to health effects of all the toxic substances released.
And some research that I've just completed, there are over 319 hotspots in the city of New Orleans where arsenic levels, levels of lead, levels of benzene, levels of diesel fuel are so high, they're 300 times the level that the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality requires a cleanup for. Nobody's talking about it.
Picou says those toxic releases are on top of the amount of crude oil spilled into the Gulf of Mexico because of Katrina, second only to the Exxon Valdez spill. Stresses from catastrophes can spiral downwards in what he calls a corrosive community, where nothing seems to go right. Often there is plenty of blame to go around, but his point is that people in the communities have to turn things around themselves. They can start by learning to listen to one another, and then by getting involvement from businesses and entrepreneurs. Transformation is what Picou is pitching these days.
And people in the community partner on an equal status basis. They can invent things that work. You promote what I call transformational role behavior. You make victims active participants in recovery.
He points out that Walmart had a far more effective response to Katrina than the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Steve Biku listed genetically modified species, especially fish, and avian influenza as potential catastrophic threats to Alaska. He said already the bird flu has been found in the Russian Far East, which, as Americans infamously know now, is not all that far away from Alaska.
I can see H5N1 from my front yard. No, I'm serious. That's what you better look at.
Biku estimates the time he's spent on field research in Alaska since 1989 totals about 2.5 years. He says he's no expert on disease, genetics, or climate, but he doesn't have to be one to forecast that the increasing number of catastrophic events will continue its upward trend. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska is getting its first large-scale wood pellet plant. A new Alaska company, Superior Pellet Fuels, plans to build a facility in North Pole this summer. The company will process local waste wood from forest clearing projects and sawmills into a dry, clean-burning fuel for pellet stoves and boilers. Company manager Chad Schumacher says at current prices, pellets are an economical heating fuel.
We expect to sell our material for around $275 a ton. You know, I would imagine anywhere from 6 to 8 tons for an entire year will be what a single home will have to utilize.
Schumacher says heating with wood pellets is more economical than heating with oil, down to the $2 a gallon price range. He says research shows there's demand for pellets in Alaska.
When we first started looking at this 3 years ago, it was definitely a chicken or the egg deal. Whether, you know, if we build the pellet facility before we build some market, it was a real concern. And at that point, the only distribution of wood pellets, you know, on a bulk scale was through Lowe's. Since then, there's now, I believe, 6 different box stores that are selling wood pellets and has really, you know, allowed that market to grow.
Schumacher says Superior Pellet Fuels is working with Alaska stove and boiler dealers to ensure appliances are available for consumers who want to switch to pellets for heating. Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation is helping facilitate the project. Fedco CEO Jim Dodson says the market for waste wood and the pellet plant will create could leverage the startup of new local forest products businesses. The pellet plant is scheduled to employ 12 to 15 workers when it goes into production in September. Superior Pellet Fuels Schumacher says the plan is to ship pellets around the interior, including to bush communities, and potentially build additional processing plants in other areas of the state. Meanwhile, a smaller pellet operation underway near Delta Junction promises to meet more localized demand. Logging and Milling Associates in Dry Creek added the pellet mill to its operation last fall. Business partner Tom Nearbon says the pelletizer turns mill waste into a marketable product.
We have a lot of waste from our planer shavings. We have a planer operation down here. So we end up having between 100 and 150 tons of kiln-dried material every year that we've just been throwing away and just letting sit outside. So we want to take advantage of that, really, and just kind of become totally integrated in our whole system.
Nearbon says they produced about 20 tons of pellets so far and received positive feedback from local customers. He says the pellets sell for about $300 a ton. The Bering Sea pollock fishery officially opened on January 20th. But 2 weeks later, most of the fleet hasn't left the port. KUCB's Ann Hillman in Unalaska found out why.
Pollock fishing is getting a slow start this year, and most of the fleet is still sitting in port. Sylvia Adafa, who began working in the industry more than 25 years ago, says delaying the harvest is good for the quality of the fishery.
Basically, as pollock school and move into the Bering Sea in schooled conditions, that's when you get a better quality fish in even sizes, and the roe quality improves. And so that's what we're waiting for. And as I said, we expect things to start happening probably by the end of this week.
High-quality fish and roe means more money for the fishermen and the processing plants, Edifa explains that waiting until the pollock school also helps the rest of the ecosystem by reducing bycatch, especially salmon bycatch. Salmon bycatch was a problem for the pollock fishery in previous years. Edifa says the late schooling is not unusual. The same thing happened during the 1980s and the late 1990s. They schooled earlier in the early 2000s, but this is just part of the pollock cycle. Edifa, who is co-op manager for Alyeska, says it's having a mixed impact on the processing plants.
It's a little tough for them because they have so many processors that they're housing and trying to keep busy. But in the end, I think it'll be better for the processing plants as well, because they'll be able to make a better product out of what comes in instead of just fishing whatever. Again, scratching is when your catch rate is low, and when you scratch in a pollock fishery, you get a lot of bycatch of things that you don't intend to catch. And so what you deliver into a processor isn't as good a quality as when fishing improves. So I think overall it'll probably work out for the processors as well. Might hurt in the beginning, but in the big picture sense, it'll be better.
Though it may be better for the plants in the end, it's hurting some of the processor workers now. Tyrell Troutman is working his first season at Unicy. He came up from Georgia to try to earn money for his family while his girlfriend goes to school.
It's kind of rough, you know, three kids and everything, and now it's like no work. So I've been up here about a month now and probably made about $200. So it's really bad right now.
The plant provides food and housing, even though most employees are not working. But Troutman isn't making anything to send home.
And then out of 1,300 people, they're trying to fit everybody into just working crab, and we getting maybe 3 days out of 2 weeks worth of work.
At $7.15 an hour, he says it doesn't add up very fast without any overtime pay to supplement it. He and his coworkers were promised 1,500 hours in 40 to 45 days. Hector Medina from Seattle says he passes his time eating, sleeping, and playing basketball, but he'd rather be making money.
And if we decide to quit, then we have to pay our own fly back, so we can't quit.
He says he'll see how the rest of A season plays out before deciding if he'll return for B season as he originally planned. In Onalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're an artist who expresses yourself creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance, you may be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant. You can learn more online at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The state is sending close to $10 million in cruise ship passenger fees to about a dozen Alaska coastal communities. State tax official Joanna Bales says all communities should receive their payments by this week. They range from $3,000 for Homer to $4 million for Skagway. She says amounts are based on the number of passengers visiting each qualifying port.
The passengers must get off the vessel. Either they get on to the ship at that port of call or they get off. The ship itself doesn't have to dock, but if they weigh anchor out in the waters and then they lighter their passengers into that port, that would be determined considered to be a port of call as well.
A statewide initiative approved by voters in 2006 created what's called the head tax. Each passenger pays $46, which is distributed directly to communities or appropriated by the state. The funds must be used to support the industry or cover passenger impacts. Another $4 per person fee pays for the Ocean Rangers monitoring program. Juneau and the city of Ketchikan do not get a share of the tax because they charge their own fees. The money is from 2008 calendar year cruises. Petersburg and Wrangell's political fight over new hydropower development at Ruth Lake near Petersburg came up at a meeting of the Thomas Bay Power Authority last week. The authority is made up of representatives from both towns, which have cooperated for decades to manage the existing hydro plant they share at Tai Lake near Wrangell. From member station KFSK in Petersburg, Matt Lichtenstein has the story.
The proposed hydro development at Ruth Lake was not on the agenda at the Thomas Bay Power Authority meeting in Petersburg, but it was a top story in the news over the past month. The City Council and the Wrangell Borough Assembly each voted in January to file competing applications for an exclusive federal permit to study potential hydro development at the lake, which is located in the mountains of Thomas Bay, just northeast of Petersburg. The competition over the Ruth Lake permit's been disappointing to Don Koenigs, a former mayor and city manager from Petersburg, who raised the issue with his fellow Power Authority commissioners at the end of the authority's recent meeting.
And I'm really disappointed in both the city of Petersburg and actually in moreover in the city of Wrangell. This board itself was formed by those two entities to work collaboratively to create an energy program which resulted in TAI, which both communities have benefited from. And now we seem to be, as our community seem to be divided.
As Koenig spoke, he made it clear he was not directing his criticism at the other commissioners on the authority. They've continued to work cooperatively despite the Ruth Lake issue. Rather, Koenig was mainly dismayed that the Wrangell Assembly had turned down a Petersburg offer to partner on a public project at Ruth Lake. Instead, the Assembly chose to work with Cascade Creek LLC, a private company based in Bellingham, Washington. That's led to political discord between the Petersburg Council and the Wrangell Assembly, and Koenig said it was counterproductive. He appealed to Wrangell to work with Petersburg.
Petersburg would like to be partners with Wrangell where we can and prudently in developing projects. How would Wrangell feel if Petersburg went and filed on Sunrise Lake and said, well, okay, we decide we're playing this game in the sandbox of throwing sand in each other's face. It doesn't work. And why screw a good thing up by becoming divided?
That division has mainly centered around Cascade Creek LLC's plans for a series of hydro facilities at three mountaintop lakes in Thomas Bay, including Ruth. The company's proposal prompted widespread local opposition among Petersburg residents and the city council, who did not want to see such a large private development in the popular bay, especially by an outside interest. There has been public support in Petersburg for the concept of a smaller city-owned project just at Ruth Lake. However, the majority of Wrangell's assembly say the private company's plans will lead to economic development for their community and the region, particularly through the construction of a proposed road and electric intertie that could allow for the sale of power to Canada in the lower 48. Power Authority Commission member Paul Southland, a former city councilor from Wrangell, said he agreed with Koenigs that it was in the community's best interest to work together. He was hopeful the commission could help find some areas of consensus.
But we also have to recognize that in some respects there are some honest differences of opinion that our two communities have, and we see that at our council levels. I hope here in this commission we can reach common ground and that we'll be able to be an example to our councils and assemblies that we can continue to work together.
In Washington, D.C. this month, both Petersburg and Wrangell are expected to have representatives file competing applications for the preliminary permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Whoever is awarded the three-year permit gets exclusive rights to study and plan for hydro development at the lake. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Anne Hillman in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Steve Heimel from Anchorage, and Libby Casey from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority. And by the new AT&T, your world delivered.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.